Beloved ones of God, may I ask you to arise with me, and we'll begin with a prayer. It is the prayer psalm. For those who know it, you are invited to join in saying the words. If you do not know the words, you may simply follow the meaning in silence.
Praise be to thee, most supreme God. Omnipotent, omnipresent, all-pervading, the only being. Take us in thy parental arms. Raise us from the denseness of the earth. Thy beauty do we worship. To thee do we give willing surrender. Most merciful and compassionate God, the idealized Lord of the whole humanity, thee only do we worship, and toward thee alone do we aspire. Open our hearts toward thy beauty. Illuminate our souls with divine light. O thou, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, all-powerful creator, sustainer, judge, and forgiver of our shortcomings, Lord God of the East and of the West, of the worlds above and below, and of the seen and unseen beings. Pour upon us thy love and thy light. Give sustenance to our bodies, hearts, and souls. Use us for the purpose that thy wisdom chooseth, and guide us on the path of thine own goodness. Draw us closer to thee every moment of our life, until in us be reflected thy grace, thy glory, thy wisdom, thy joy, and thy peace.
Holding the sacred attunement of the prayer, let us now practice an invocation using words of Hazrat Inayat Khan. You are my spirit. I am thy body, my Holy One. As we say this invocation, we will move our hands. So when we begin, as we say, "You are my spirit." Raise the hands like this. And then we'll say, "I am thy body." Bring the hands over the knees. And we conclude, "My Holy One." Bring the hands across the chest like this and incline down toward the heart, feeling the presence of the Beloved in the heart. So we'll say this invocation with movements together a few times. And keep your eyes open except when you turn within into the heart. You are my spirit. I am thy body. My Holy One. You are my spirit. I am thy body. My Holy One. You are my spirit. I am thy body. My Holy One. You are my spirit. I am thy body. My Holy One. You are my spirit. I am thy body. My Holy One. My Holy One. My Holy One. My Holy. My Holy One. Yes. And Nuruddin will now bring this practice into a musical form.
Please join with me. I'm going to be doing a musical chant that follows the practice that we just did. And you have a part. If you could please sing the refrain, the repeat of the refrain, "My Holy One," when it comes up.
Holy One, my Holy One, you are my Spirit, I am thy body, my Holy One, my Holy One, you are my Spirit. I am thy body, my Holy One, my Holy One. You are my Spirit, I am thy body, my Holy. My Holy One, 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 my Holy. My Holy One, 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 my Holy One. You are my Spirit, I am thy body. My holy one, my holy one.
toward the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. Beloved ones of God, dear friends, it's wonderful to be here with you, and I would like to begin by thanking most sincerely Sheikh Llewellyn and the staff and volunteers of the Golden Sufi Center, who have so graciously invited us and have gone to such lengths to bring about a communion of seekers and Sufis from many paths coming together to celebrate the oneness of being. It's a great gift that Sheikh Llewellyn and the Golden Sufi Center have offered us. And in particular, I would like to mention Cleary with great thanks. And also, each of you has come in what seems, as Sheikh Llewellyn said, to be a simple act of presence. But in forming your intention, you have contributed to the intention of this gathering. And this gathering carries a single intention, which contributes to a larger intention. And in this way, the realization of the divine unity is awakened in humanity. If you have come here, it is because you want more than the endless routines of production and consumption. You want communion. You want to actualize the experience of the unity of being. You want to unite inner and outer. Prayers and invocations that I have invoked this morning are from the tradition of my grandfather, Hazrat Pir Murshid Inayat Khan, who brought the message of Sufism to the West in 1910. In doing so, he was not simply bringing the tradition of one place to another place. He was bringing his lineage within the global tradition of spiritual awakening into an era that has been characterized by the sociologist Max Weber. As a disenchanted world, a world of progressive rationalization, technical expertise, in which wonderful inventions have become produced, and we all benefit from advances in medicine and in science. And yet, something essential has been lost. Perhaps it could be described as the presence of the sacred. And there are good reasons for that loss. When the sacred is appropriated as an instrument for exclusion and oppression, its purpose in human destiny has become obscured. And so there are, in the history of human civilization, moments of infidelity, of deconstruction, in which the old forms must break down. But nihilism will not suffice. It is part of a larger dialectic which awaits, in our time, the return of the sacred, not according to the old forms, not channeled within the old tribal identities, but awakened now today within the context of the global unification that we see emerging before our eyes. Patterns of immigration, of communication, of integrated markets produce a world which is radically different than any known by our ancestors. History is accelerating. And the fulfillment, the consummation of this globalization is impossible in the absence of the sacred communion, which is the true source and goal of life on earth. This is the message of the mystics of all traditions, a message which is being brought forth into the exoteric domain in our time, as was never before possible or necessary. And what the perspective of mysticism reveals is the truth of all divinely revealed religions. Now you may ask, if religions are different, how can they all be true? There seem to be three possibilities. One religion is true, and the rest are false. Or all are false, or yet somehow all are true. And yet how could that be? Well, if one is true, and the rest are false, this is a claim that is made by votaries of all of the world's traditions. And one may ask where it has gotten us. the claim of absolute truth, when it appears repeated again and again, begins to look increasingly absurd. And moreover, one finds that each religious institution makes its claims on the basis of the denial of the claims of another. And so the claim itself is inherently dualistic, polarizing. And it is precisely this that is disuniting the world. In my own homeland of Gujarat, the birthplace of my grandfather is torn apart at this very moment by two religious traditions, each claiming its prerogative, each claiming its absolute truth. And the consequence is bonfires of human bodies, women and children, sacrificed to the name of God. We see this throughout the world. And so, we may be tempted to answer, no, I cannot abide it. This is cruel. If this is what religion is, no religion is true. All of these claims must now be left aside. No religion can claim truth. But where does this bring us? To a world defined by consumption, the world of the marketplace, in which the highest possible ideal is mere self-gratification. There is no greater ideal, no more exalted purpose. In the absence of the sacred, morality is relative. There must be a third choice, a tertium quid. The validity of the sacred, but the relativity of forms. Yet how can it be? How can each tradition be absolutely authentic? We might consult biology. We might consider our own bodies. And if we do, we discover that each cell contains the DNA, the code of the whole. And so the information for the entire body is contained in every particle of the body. And yet, that DNA is transcribed into RNA, and through the RNA is the basis for the construction of the cell as an individual unit, forming the basis for the tissue, and the tissue for the organ, and the organ as part of a system. So each part of the body individuates the truth of the whole to serve the purpose of the whole, because the whole is not undifferentiated. It is not inorganic, but organic. It is a living being with living parts. And all of the different parts contribute to the purposefulness of the whole. And so it is with the religious traditions, that each contains the complete code in its perfection, in its totality. Nothing is missing. And yet the way in which that code is translated is for the purpose that that tradition must fulfill in the larger body of the human experience. Each religious tradition serving its purpose in community with the other religions to fulfill the purpose of the human experience. And when one cell or one organ claims its own paramountcy, refuses communication and collaboration, that is precisely the definition of cancer. It wishes to make the whole body in its own image, and the body must perish. So we can see amongst the religious traditions a great diversity of practices, but we also can discover what is essential in all traditions. And among the world's many sacred traditions, one finds that prayer is at the heart of it all. So many different forms of prayer. In one tradition, when you say your prayer, you must take off your hat. In another, to pray, you must wear a hat. But the purpose is the same, to make an intention oriented toward communion. So in these moments this morning with you, I would like to share with you some perspectives on the practice of prayer in the Sufi tradition that come from the teachings of my grandfather, Hazrat Pir Murshid Inayat Khan, and to invoke in connection with each of these five modalities of prayer, which I will speak of, the five elements of incarnation. In the spirit of the theme of this conference, uniting inner and outer, to perceive the connection between the inner postures of prayer and the outer forms which articulate the divine in manifestation, the forms of the five elements. This is an ancient teaching which can be traced back to the great mystic philosopher Empedocles, and which was absorbed by the Sufi mystics through the mediacy of a great Gnostic alchemist Sufi of Egypt, Zunnun Misri, and which in India was developed in combination with the teaching of the Mahabhutas, the five great elemental essences. And so in our exploration this morning, we will be discovering sympathetic connections between the modes of prayer and the elemental essences. In Sufi cosmology, creation is described as an act of love, in which the divine being descended, so to speak, from the solitude of eternity in a great sigh of creative compassion, Nafasa Rahman, a breath of life-giving mercy, a loving longing moving toward the creation of you. And that universal breath, that breath of all breaths, progressively crystallized in stages of manifestation as ether, as air, as fire, as water, and as earth, the densest of the elements. And thus emerged a spectrum of cosmic experience from the most dense and particular to the most refined and abstract. And each of the elements represent a field of experience, a field of divine presence within that spectrum, what the Sufis called Shahid al-Wujud, a witness of being. And each element has its mode of prayer. The whole of the cosmos is praying to its source and goal. The birds in the sky, the worms in the earth, all are praying, each in its own way. Prayer can be a form, a collective practice according to traditional rules, or it can be a moment of spontaneous remembrance. What is essential in prayer is the intention, sincerity. Story is told that once an old man, an old ascetic, was bent over in prayer. And it happened that a young lady walked right in front of him. And as you may know, that is, that's a mistake. Because it's as if one comes between the worshipper and God. To walk in front of someone who's engaged in prayer, it's always better to walk behind. But in this case, that woman just brazenly walked right in front of him. And he noticed in the corner of his eye. And immediately, he finished up his prayer as quickly as he could and raced after her and seized her by the collar and said, "Young lady, do you realize what you just did? I was engaged in the most pious of acts, and there you just walked right in front of me." And she looked at him, stunned for a moment, and she said, "Sir, forgive me. I didn't see you. I was going to see my boyfriend. And my heart was so full of love for him, I was thinking only of him. I didn't see you at all. Please forgive me." And then she paused and said, "But you who were with your beloved in prayer, how is it that you could see me?" This story does not question the validity and importance of a ritual of prayer, but it reminds us that what is most essential is not the form, not vain repetitions. It is the quality of an inner attentiveness, quality of presence. That is the essence of prayer. And to whichever direction it is addressed, whether to an idol, to a beloved, or to the highest perception of the divine ideal, if it is sincere, it is moving in the right direction. Now, there are five modes of prayer that we might consider. The first, perhaps most basic, is thanksgiving, offering gratitude. We're fortunate in this country, thanks, I think, to the heritage of the native people, to have a tradition, an annual holiday called Thanksgiving, in which we gather together and count our blessings.
instead of what we usually do, which is to count our grievances, enumerate our complaints, but to actually count the things that we're thankful for. It's a wonderful spiritual practice and most necessary. But once a year is not enough. Once a day would be perhaps better. That is what the Sufis call muhasaba, which is making an accounting. To be an accountant of your own spiritual life. Just as you might tally up your bills and income, in the same way, make a record of all of the grace and mercy that you receive in your life. Through nature, through your relationships, through the privileges that you enjoy in this free society. All of the blessings of life deserve our constant attention and appreciation. Because otherwise we find that we only value what we have when it's gone. Again and again, we find that that which we took for granted, we realize its intense importance to us only when it's gone. And then an opportunity has been lost. In fact, one might even say that in a state of ingratitude, that which is present in our lives is really absent to us. And in a state of gratitude, even that which has become absent is present to our heart. So in the way of the Sufi practice of muhasaba, I want to invite us to turn within for a moment. Let me share with you first a most moving story. It's the story of Ayaz, who was a servant at the court of the king Mahmud Ghaznavi, the king of Afghanistan. And he had many, many servants. And one day he called them all to the throne room, and he placed in the hand of each one of them a precious crystal goblet. And he ordered them, throw down the glass. And each of them in turn dropped the glass, and it shattered. And then he looked at each one in turn and asked them, why did you break the glass? And each one answered, protesting his innocence, sir, but sir, you commanded it. I had to do it. Until one, the last. And that was Ayaz. He said, forgive me, sir. And the Sultan was so touched by his quality of servanthood that he promoted him to the highest place in the court. He made him the prime minister, and he was entrusted with the greatest responsibility as a statesman. He was given a palace
and great wealth. And naturally, the other servants became jealous that one from among them was so suddenly promoted. And they began to conspire against him, wanting to ruin his reputation. And they noticed that every day he went into the vault, the treasury of the king. And they thought, aha, we've got him. He's pilfering. And so they went to the king and said, Your Highness, Ayaz is untrue to you. Every day he goes to the treasury and takes something surreptitiously. And Sultan Mahmud said, I can't believe it. I would never believe it of Ayaz. I would have to see it to believe it. And they said, all right, we'll make a hole in the wall. And so the king was waiting with the servants behind the wall, looking through the hole. And Ayaz went into the treasury, as was his daily routine. And he went to the corner where there was a chest, and he unlocked the chest. And the servant, seeing this, said, you see, he's doing it. But when he opened the chest, he took out an old, ragged robe, soiled and patched, and he took off his fine brocade dress. He took off all of his ornaments and respectfully, with great dignity, put them aside and took up that old tattered robe and wore it and stood before a mirror in the treasury. And looking at that himself in the mirror, he addressed himself and said, Oh, Ayaz, this is who you have been. Remember who you are. And all of this dignity, all of this wealth that you enjoy, all of it is by the grace of the king. Without the king, this is who you are. Remember it with gratitude and always be true to him. And seeing this, the Sultan Mahmud was moved to tears, and he was confirmed in his faith in his loyal servant Ayaz. I cannot imagine a more perfect instruction in the art of gratitude that is taught in the Sufi tradition. To take a moment, just a moment, each day, dress oneself in the dress of poverty and stand before the one being who is the source of all the wealth, all of the pleasure, all of the good fortune that we experience, and attribute all of it to the being who has been so generous. So let us take a moment now in silence, just a minute. To turn within, and feel whatever it is that is immediately arising. One need not make a clinical inventory of the good fortune that one experiences, but rather just look for what is calling out to be named. Keep it simple. It may be a person in your life. It may be a feature of the natural environment. It may be a sensation. Whatever it is, feel its importance and give thanks for its presence.